Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu returned from the United States and threatened swift retaliation for an attack from Lebanon that killed a dozen young people Saturday. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman.
It marks the single deadliest attack in Israel or Israeli-annexed territory since Hamas's assault sparked the Gaza War on October 7th. And it is fueling fears of significant escalation between Israel and Hezbollah militants in Lebanon. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said he visited the town of Majdal Shams early on Sunday, describing the site of the attack as, quote, a place where innocent girls and boys were murdered during a soccer game. He vowed to retaliate against Hezbollah for the strike. Hezbollah initially announced it fired rockets at Israeli military sites in the Golan Heights, but denied involvement in the attack on Majdal Shams.
The United States recently announced a plan to deploying long-range missiles to Germany by 2026, as experts worry the readiness of both Russia and the U.S. to deploy intermediate-range Western weapons could spark a new arms race. VOA's Arash Arabasadi.
In a recent joint statement from the White House, U.S. and German officials said exercising advanced capabilities would demonstrate a commitment to NATO and its contributions to European integrated deterrence. Despite the Kremlin's latest round of saber-rattling, the Russian Defense Ministry began releasing videos showcasing intercontinental ballistic missile tests days before its 2022 invasion of Ukraine. Putin at the time discussed plans to assemble his army's so-called deterrent force to potentially include a nuclear component. It is language that NATO calls dangerous and irresponsible. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Ukraine says it has struck an oil depot in southern Russia that supplies the Kremlin's troops. As Russian strikes in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region, where Moscow has claimed further gains, have left 5 civilians dead, 15 others wounded. North Korea says more than 5,000 people were rescued from weakened flooding and airlifts and other evacuation efforts supervised by the leader Kim Jong-un. The state media report Monday said rainfall Saturday caused a river on the North Korean-Chinese border to rise and created a grave crisis. It said Kim supervised the evacuation in the city and town in the north-northwest. About 10 military helicopters and Navy and government boats were mobilized for the evacuation effort. A manipulated video shared by Elon Musk is raising concerns about AI in politics just 3 months away from November's U.S. elections. Details from VOA's Joe Ramsey.
The video features a voice that mimics U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, and the voice says things she does not say. The video gained attention over the weekend after tech billionaire Elon Musk shared it on his social media platform X on Friday. The video uses many of the same visuals as a real ad the Harris campaign released, but it swaps out the voice over audio with a convincing impersonation. A Harris spokesperson referred to the video as fake, manipulated lies. AI experts and pro-democracy advocates say the video reveals shortcomings in how AI companies, social platforms, and the federal government regulate use of AI in politics. Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Lawmakers from at least 6 countries say Beijing is pressuring them not to attend a summit in Taiwan on Monday. AP correspondent Karen Chalmers.
Politicians in Bolivia, Colombia, Slovakia, North Macedonia, Bosnia, and one other Asian country that declined to be named say they've been contacted to meet by Chinese officials. The contact appears to be an attempt to stop the politicians from attending Interparliamentary Alliance on China summit in Taiwan. The summit, known as IPAC, is attended by a group of hundreds of lawmakers from 35 countries concerned about how democracies approach Beijing. Luke de Pulford, the alliance's director, says the pressure from Chinese officials the past few days has been unprecedented. China strongly defends its claim to Taiwan and views it as its own territory to be annexed by force if necessary. I'm Karen Chavez.
A court in Libya has sentenced 12 current and former officials to terms of up to 27 years in prison over their involvement in the collapse of 2 dams last year that sent a wall of water several meters high through the center of a coastal city. Thousands of people died. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I am Chinedofo in Washington. Today is Monday, July 29th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Nigeria places security agencies on alert ahead of a nationwide protest scheduled for August 1st.
The atmosphere is charged with a level of uncertainty. First, the uncertainty revolves around the amorphous nature of the persons who are said to be organizing the protest. It's very possible.
The U.S. government sanctions three rebel leaders accused of fomenting political instability, conflict, and civilian displacement in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
U.S. Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control on imposed sanctions on Corneille Nangaa, leader of the Congo River Alliance. The rebel group is accused of seeking to overthrow the government.
Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's sports, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The president of Nigeria, Bola Tinubu, has beefed up security at all the nation's borders and cities ahead of a planned, quote, hunger, unquote, protest scheduled nationwide for August 1st. Citizens have also stocked up food and essentials as organizers have vowed to shut down markets and cripple commercial activities. Frank Tete, the executive director of the group called Citizens Advocacy for Social and Economic Rights, describes the mood in the country.
The atmosphere is charged with a level of uncertainty. First, the uncertainty revolves around the amorphous nature of the persons who are said to be organizing the protest. It's very palpable, and we are witnessing a flurry of groups holding press conferences across the city to announce their dissociation from the planned protest.
Some are saying that President Bola Tinubu did not move fast enough to address the underlying concerns of those planning these protests. But the government is saying it needs more time to actually put measures in place to take care of hunger, tackle the social issues.
The idea is that citizens find it to be quite ironical that the president was not in any way patient in instituting reforms, which included the immediate removal of subsidy and then the floating of the Naira, both policies of government that triggered untold hardship in the immediate terms on the entire population. Now, it becomes very strange as the people consider that the president is telling them to be patient, whereas the president wasn't patient on his part because it was thought that the president could have done it in a more gradual manner, in a facile manner, so that the impact of the removal of subsidy and floating of the Naira for an economy that is largely and hugely dependent on imports is something that the president was too swift. And as such, their demands, it's clear that the president should make a sharp U-turn and reverse the policies of removal of subsidies and floating of the Naira against the U.S. dollar.
Supporters of the government and even President Bola Tinubu says that he has already increased the minimum wage by over 100% and that given more time, he has the potential to address other issues. Is the minimum wage not enough as at this moment?
It is very far from it. We are talking about a minimum wage that can only affect less than 5% of the population. Those are the far lesser number that are directly employed by the federal government. So the increase in minimum wage is an attestation to the increased inflation, which will also buttress the fact that prices are bound to go up in response to the wide understanding in the marketplace that wages have been increased. Yet, we are talking about a small number of Nigerians whose wages have been increased by the new minimum wage act that has been signed to law.
And what are your thoughts about fears by some state governors, some actors in the Nigerian political scene, that this might get out of hand? Even the federal government is already blaming quote-unquote mercenaries as being part of this planned protest.
I think that if a people are planning a protest and they give a notice to government, the presumption is that they are well-meaning. There is no spontaneity like we found the case of the Arab Spring, unlike what we experienced in other parts of the continent, particularly Kenya. The organizers are putting the government on notice. and telling the government plainly that this is what they want, and giving an opportunity to the government to correct the wrongs and make some fundamental and significant changes that can assuage their minds. So I think that the fear of the government is unnecessary. The government could have responded in more meaningful terms than engaging in a campaign that tends to criminalize those who are planning the protest and also dissuading many groups from getting involved.
That's Frank Cheche, the Executive Director of Citizens Advocacy for Social and Economic Rights, speaking with me from the capital city of Abuja. The U.S. government has sanctioned three rebel leaders accused of fomenting political instability, conflicts and civilian displacement in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
The U.S. Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control on Thursday imposed sanctions on Corneille Nangaa, leader of the Congo River Alliance. The rebel group is accused of seeking to overthrow the government and driving political instability in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Nangaa was previously targeted with sanctions in 2019. Washington also sanctioned Bertrand Bisimwa, the leader of the M23 movement rebel group, for destabilization and human rights violations. Charles Sematama, deputy military leader of another rebel group, Twirwaniho, was also sanctioned. Great Lakes region political researcher and analyst Ntanyoma Rukombuzi says the U.S. is trying to show that it cares about the DRC and wants to punish those who want to create instability in the Central African nation.
The U.S. Wants to convince the Congolese general audience that they are standing with them, that they are paying attention on what's happening in DRC, that they can still do something to push or force the rebel group to stop fighting. As you can see, some of these sanctions seem to disregard and overlook the entire complexity of violence in Eastern DRC.
The U.S. government said in a statement the action it is taking reinforces its commitment to hold accountable those who seek to perpetuate instability, violence and harm to civilians to achieve their political goals. The M23 as a group is also under U.S. sanctions. For several years it has been fighting against the Congolese army and other rebel groups in the east of the country. According to the UN estimates, more than 7.2 million Congolese are displaced due to conflicts. Olivier Banibonerba is a Congolese refugee living in Uganda. He says U.S. sanctions won't end the suffering of the Congolese. He says we are not in politics, but says the rebels are coming to my home to cut me with a machete. Even that Nangaa, the American government says it will freeze his assets, but there is a country that is supporting Nangaa. He says that country has the money, it will continue to fund him, and the killing goes on. The Congolese government has accused Rwanda of supporting the M23 rebel group, a claim denied by Kigali. Rukombuzi also says the sanctions won't stop the operations of the rebel groups.
They've been fighting for several reasons. There are different individuals and groups who have something to fight for. I'm sure may disturb them at the time they be trying to understand why this and possibly trying to take the way roles can be dispatched to different individuals. This won't stop the rebels to fight.
The U.S. hopes the sanctions against these leaders and groups will change their violent ways and convince them to find a peaceful means to address their grievances instead of killing and displacing innocent people from their homes. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
And in Kenya, there have been attacks, arrests and restrictions on journalists over coverage of recent youth demonstrations. Now, journalists are taking to the streets to protest. Juma Majanga has this report from Nairobi.
We are not criminals! Journalists march in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, one of several countrywide demonstrations over police attacks on media as they cover youth-led protests. Stephen Leto is a journalist taking part in the demonstration.
Basically trying to say we are also opposed to censorship of media. We are opposed to what the government dictates, what it wants us to air, but we want to be allowed and given a free space to practice and to ensure that we deliver the news to the people because we are the fourth estate.
Media freedom is guaranteed under the Constitution, but the Kenya Editors Guild says the government attempts to interfere with that right. Reaction to media coverage of youth-led protests underscores that challenge, says Guild President Zubeida Kananu. Some media organizations are targeted with smear campaigns and threats of license withdrawal, she says. Kananu, too, has received threatening calls and messages.
They've used all means to create fear among journalists, me being one of them, for calling out the government.
In the past month, the Media Council of Kenya has documented more than 20 press freedom violations by police and protesters. Incidents include arbitrary arrest, assault and threats. K24 journalist Catherine Wanjeri was hit in the leg by rubber bullets despite being clearly visible as press. And parliamentary reporters, including Elizabeth Mutuku of TV47, say they were banned from parliament following coverage of how protesters stormed parliament.
Our greatest mistake, which we did that day, was to show Kenyans exactly what transpired. Some of us have been labeled out as criminals, and we are told that investigations is going on. And our question is, what investigations?
The National Assembly leader denies media were blocked from parliament. A police spokesperson declined to comment to VOA. And calls and messages to government spokesperson went unanswered. That spokesperson has said previously the government has no quarrel with the media. Safety specialists like Media Council's Dina Ondari say the situation is frustrating.
The police who are attacking journalists, unfortunately, are the ones who have a responsibility within the law to arrest the perpetrators of press freedom violations.
Kenya ranked 102 on the World Press Freedom Index, with Reporters Without Borders noting risks for journalists covering politics.
It's really frustrating, you know, that we no longer feel safe in Kenya. We no longer feel at home as journalists in Kenya. Because every time you express yourself, you're looking back, watching over your shoulder to see who is following you, who is targeting you.
Kenya has strong laws on press freedom, but media experts say more political goodwill is needed to guarantee rights. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Juma. Democrats have warned that former President Donald Trump will destroy democratic institutions if he's re-elected to the highest office in the land in November. But Trump has said that democracy will end if he's not re-elected in 2024. VOA's Dora Makora explores whether any president has the power to destroy democracy.
The Constitution is America's founding document. It outlines three branches of government: the executive, including the presidency, the legislative, the House of Representatives and the Senate, and the judicial, the Supreme Court and other courts. Each branch is intended to keep the others in check. This separation of powers is at the heart of American democracy. Ronald Chen is a law professor at Rutgers University.
We are navigating somewhat uncharted waters because of the assumed willingness of President Trump, if he were to be reelected, to explore the outer boundaries, including beyond where presidents had gone before.
I only want to be a dictator for one day, and I'm going to be a dictator, Sean, for one day.
Former President Donald Trump says he won't be a dictator beyond day one if he's reelected. But what if a future president did try to exceed his or her power? Here's Chen again.
If the allegation is that one branch is just simply going to run roughshod over the separation of powers, frankly, I don't know if it has yet been determined whether our system is strong enough to withstand that.
He has openly said he will be a dictator on day one.
One of the core campaign messages of likely Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris is that Trump is a threat to democracy. Democrats point to Trump's unwillingness to accept the results of the 2020 election and the subsequent January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol.
Ours is a fight for freedom. Across our nation, we are witnessing a full-on assault on hard-fought, hard-won freedoms and rights.
They keep saying, he's a threat to democracy. I'm saying, what the hell did I do for democracy? Last week, I took a bullet for democracy.
Voters aren't necessarily buying into the argument that U.S. democracy is in peril. Chris Edelson is with American University.
I was talking to somebody a few weeks ago who said, you know, you hear all these things about Donald Trump trying to overthrow democracy, but he didn't do it.
David Ramadan of George Mason University.
There's some sentiment among some of the independent voters that, well, it worked. The system worked, right? The transfer of power did take place, so we're okay.
It's not easy for a populist leader to destroy democracy, according to Kurt Weiland, who studies democracy and authoritarian rule.
Only happens if there's some real institutional weakness and some very special conjunctural opportunity. And so my argument is that in the United States, those conditions really don't apply.
Weiland says a number of factors limit a president from taking complete power, including good actors in public roles. He points to Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who refused to help overturn the 2020 election when Trump asked him to find extra Trump votes.
American democracy is strong and resilient, and the American people are committed to it, and American office holders are committed to fulfilling their institutional duties.
Weiland says leaders have a better chance of destroying democracy when they have massive popular support, with approval ratings well over 70%. Trump's highest approval rating as president was 49%. Biden's was 57%. Dora McQuarrie, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I am Chinua Adolfo in Washington. Today is Monday, July 29th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Namibia is one of Africa's top five diamond exporters behind Angola, Botswana, and South Africa. In 2022, the country exported more than $940 million worth of diamonds. However, the head of the country's largest marine diamond company is worried about competition from synthetic diamonds, a sector of the business that could cost many Namibians their jobs. Vitaly Angula reports from Windhoek.
The world's demand for natural diamonds has bounced back from a slump during the COVID-19 pandemic, with Namibia's marine diamond mining company, Dead Marine, reporting a sales increase of 83% in 2022 from the previous year. However, the company's CEO, Willie Mertens, is concerned about the rising popularity of lab-grown synthetic diamonds. There's nothing obvious to distinguish artificial diamonds from natural diamonds, though trained jewelers can tell the difference. The Modern Mining publication recently said that in 2022, lab-grown diamond jewelry surpassed 10% of the market of global jewelry sales for the first time. The publication said artificial diamond sales are forecast to continue growing at an annual double-digit percentage rate in coming years. Namibia, where workers extracted 2.1 million carats in diamonds in 2022, is embarking on a campaign to tout natural diamonds as environmentally sound and holding greater value for money.
We've seen in the last couple of years that lab-grown diamonds, or synthetics as you're calling them, have sort of infiltrated the natural diamond market. And that is, that's probably came about, the initial thing was about people were first marketing them as real diamonds. We've done a lot of work around trying to differentiate them.
One of the challenges of marketing Namibian natural diamonds is the environmental impact that diamonds have on the landscape. Martin says Dead Marine invests a significant amount of its profits into environmental rehabilitation and restoration of landscapes and the seabed that has been damaged by mining.
The restoration of the seabed actually happens naturally as the waves move. So what we do is we're monitoring that. And what we do is we mine out a specific area, and we leave an area next to that vacant, if I can call it like that. And over time, we monitor how the area where we've recovered diamonds looks like compared to the one that was not touched. And we've seen that it takes about 3 to 10 years maximum for that area to completely restore. And completely restore, we mean about 80% of the organisms have returned to that place. On the land, obviously, it's sand that we are moving. And what we do now is we are actually using that same sand to keep this, to keep the seawalls intact.
Vitalio Angula for VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
And now it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, Chinedu. We begin our coverage of the 2024 Paris Olympic Games with a women's football event, as the second round of matches in the 2024 Paris Olympic Games football competition saw both African countries, Zambia and Nigeria, suffer defeats on Sunday, complicating their path to the quarterfinals. In a thrilling 11-goal encounter at the Stade Nice, Zambia went toe-to-toe with Australia's Matildas, but the Copper Queens suffered a 6-5 defeat in the last minute despite a historic hat-trick by Barbara Banda. The historic hat-trick by Barbara Banda made her the first player to score 3 hat-tricks in Olympic football history. Meanwhile, Nigeria's Super Falcons, still reeling from their opening 1-0 loss to Brazil, faced a stern test against world champions Zambia and stumbled 1-0 from a late goal. Randy Wadrum's side put up a resilient defensive display, but struggled to capitalize on their chances. In the men football event, Egypt rekindled their hope of getting into the quarterfinals after a hard-fought 1-0 victory over Uzbekistan on their second match day of the men's football tournament on Saturday. In swimming, South Africa's Tajiana Smith stayed on course to win her first medal of the Olympic Games on a day of mixed fortunes for Team South Africa in Paris. The Tokyo gold and silver medalist cruised through her morning heat of the 100 meters breaststroke and then swam exactly the same time of 1 minute 5 seconds to win the evening semifinal, ensuring she will have a shot at another medal in Monday's night final after qualifying as the quickest swimmer.
So grateful to be swimming some good times as well. I haven't been close to my time since Tokyo, so this is my best time since Tokyo. So I think obviously it's amazing to swim and make good times, but I think most of all I'm really enjoying every race and I'm much happier. So
also making his way safely through his semi-final on Sunday was 20-year-old Peter Kotze in the 100 meters backstroke. He did so by setting a new African record on his way to joint second place in his semi-final, reaching the wall in 52.63 seconds.
I wanted to get into the final because if you're in the final, you've got a chance.
In basketball, South Sudan created a major upset in their basketball event at the 2024 Paris Olympic Games on Sunday when they dispatched Puerto Rico 90-79 points to claim its first ever Olympic victory. Carlick Jones scored 19 points and South Sudan rallied in the second half to beat Puerto Rico in the Paris Olympics opener for both teams. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Chinedu, in Washington.
Thank you very much, Samson, and have a great Monday. And that's it for this Monday, July 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV show, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the entire Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Chinedu Afua in Washington, wishing you have a great week.